If you and I were having coffee in downtown cozy Columbia, Missouri, I'd be compelled to ask you right now, as of this recording, what are your thoughts on the Silicon Valley Bank closure and the banking crisis we are witnessing in the news? And for some of you, that could be firsthand. That's the question I posed to my good friend, Bruce Reed, the CFO for PracticeLink, in this special episode of CFO Bookshelf. In this discussion, I'm going to leave you with four powerful and impactful mental models or frameworks that come right out of the banking industry playbook, and you can start using those in your business right now. I'm Mark Gandy, and I think you're going to enjoy this conversation. Bruce, thanks for joining me on this special episode, this bonus episode. What have you been thinking about what's happened with Silicon Valley Bank, SVB?
Oh, wow. I mean, that's been like just, you know, hold on for dear life. On one hand, it sounds like more of the same, but it's more of the same for entirely different reasons. And it's also, you know, I mean, there's a lot of finger pointing right now and a lot of, you know, a lot of coulda, shoulda, woulda, a lot of Monday morning quarterbacking. But when you really look at the nuts and bolts of these things, you know, it's not as simple. In hindsight, it's not. I don't think some of these things are as simple as the critics would like you to believe.
That is a great point, Bruce. And by the way, this is not going to be a conversation about judgment. We'll let the regulators handle that. We'll let the pundits and we'll let everyone else in the media take care of that, as this is a very complex topic. However, this has caused me to think about four ideas. It started out with three, and then I thought of a fourth idea. These ideas all come out of banking. I ask you, what have you been thinking about? What did you think about this bank failure? Well, I thought of four things real quickly, and they are actually top of mind a lot in my daily work, because I do have a day job where I get to work with some very creative and results-centric CEOs around the United States. Idea number one, and again, this is all in response to the failure of SVB. So idea number one, and these are practical, I think. I think you don't have to be a banker to appreciate these concepts. And my four ideas have all come out of the banking industry. So here it goes. Are you familiar with camel or camels? The camel, it's actually, see, I'm old. It used to be the camel rating system, but the S was added. I don't know when. So we need to call it, in case we have any bank auditors, we need to call it the camels rating system. Have you heard of it? Are you familiar with it?
Transparency, you mentioned it to me earlier, so I'm familiar with it because you mentioned it. I did not have familiarity with it before, and I've not been hands-on either having it done with an institution that I'm working with, or, you know, even going in and looking at the output from the type of analysis.
And full transparency on this end, yes, when I was a young pup, I used to do a lot of bank auditing through a large CPA firm. And by the way, I hated it. I could do director's exams in my sleep. I felt like it got to be a point where bank auditing was just boring. I mean, really boring. And I feel like the statute of limitations have expired to where I can now say that. Notice I didn't say what firm. Notice I didn't bring up any banks. There is a little bit of familiarity. Camels, I think, this is opinion, took front stage. It got more notoriety during the great financial meltdown, during the great recession. So what camel, and again, I keep saying camel, it's camels. I just want to give you the quick, here's what it means. Here's what these letters mean in this rating system, which is 1 through 5. And by the way, I apply this regularly. If you work in the turnaround industry, I would be shocked. I mean, I would be floored if startup experts don't apply this in their tool set. But here goes. Do I have you curious?
You got me curious.
So the C stands for capital adequacy, which is huge, especially with businesses $100 million or less. There is no guarantee year after year that your LLC will be renewed. You could be brought to your knees. That's why I always start the renewal process 6 months before the line of credit. And there's a reason for that. There's a reason why I personally like to meet with my bankers every month to go over performance, because I want to make sure I have capital adequacy. Anyway, that's the C. A is assets. Now, you may be thinking, hey, I'm a service-based business, but hey, we all have intellectual capital of some type. We have that IP, that thing that we sell. So A is in assets. M is in management. And we could spend a whole hour just talking about management. Earnings, E stands for earnings. L is for liquidity. And then S is a little bit complex to me, but I think you can change it outside the banking industry. It's sensitivity to market risk, which to me, again, it's complex from at least an examiner's perspective. But I like to change sensitivity to market risk. Like when I'm talking to bankers, what could happen if the economy starts to go sour? I mean, there are some industries where we actually thrive when inflation starts going up, or there are just some industries that are really good that do well during downturns. So anyway, I apply CAMEL, again, with the S, mm-hmm. almost daily, Bruce, with my client base. Can you understand why CAMEL is relevant outside of banking?
Yeah, I mean, it seems like it kind of follows that same basic, you know, going back and nerding out from an accounting standpoint, you know, it kind of falls into those different ratios that every accountant or anybody who's really even taken basic accounting courses knows, is knowing the liquidity and the variety of risks, profitability, liquidity, asset turnaround, debt. You know, debt exposure really is kind of embodies all of the accounting ratios and financial ratios. And then talks about them in a little bit more of a banking sense, but it definitely applies.
And I know we do have a large contingent of financial types who are listening, and I'm one of those people too, but I am not about assigning a number. This is more about this should be sticky forefront of mind. For example, management. I think one of the biggest issues in small business management, and I'm talking $100 million or less, and that's blind loyalty and familiarity. And when you are overly familiar and overly loyal with your management team, sometimes it's going to mean that you're not willing to part with them, because the people who got you to 20 million, probably not going to be the people who get you to 75 million. There are going to be exceptions. So I like using this as just about once a year, maybe twice a year. Let's go through this and let's just address, are there any gaps that we need to address? Now, capital adequacy, that is front and center almost, if not weekly, monthly. Again, if that line of credit goes away or other capital sources go away, the business I work with, we could be brought to our knees. So again, I'm not about the number. It's more about using this as by the way, have you thought about this? I think this is also good to bring up in your annual retreats, your offsites. I think notice I'm not using the term strategic planning. Mm-hmm. But I think in those offsites, I think this is a good time to just go through this with the leadership team, the management team.
Yeah, the thing is, when you look at this, it's and saying it's not a number makes sense. There's a lot of these that while I can see them being quantitative, there's also a qualitative aspect to all of these different things.
Yes,
and you don't have to nerd out and dive into the. Dive into all the financial statements. You can look at this at a I think you said at a holistic level, which when you mentioned this to me initially, never came to mind. There, the way we're laying this out is kind of opening my eyes.
Can we go on to big idea number two?
Big idea number two.
And again, this is These are the things that have been on my mind since reading about SVB. And again, I'm pulling ideas right out of the banking industry.
It's ripped from the headlines.
Idea number two is stress testing. Now, I'm going to ask you a stupid question because you know the answer, but I want to see or hear if you elaborate. But in your mind, what is stress testing?
I think it's scenario. It's scenario building. It's like, okay, you know, here's all your numbers now, and here's all your drivers. Let's take this driver and make it way up, or this driver and take it way down. And let's see how this flows through your financial model. So, you know, best probable worst case scenario.
We'll be right back.
Money is all around us, and we think about it more than almost every other aspect of our lives. But how can we make more of it, and what's our drive for building wealth beyond just the numbers in our bank account? Join us on the Make More podcast as our host Matt Heslin brings to you a dynamic lineup of experts in the world of investing, business, health, and beyond. Together, they unpack the secrets to not just surviving, but thriving in today's economy. It's about more than just wealth. It's about crafting life experiences, seizing opportunities, and building a legacy. Subscribe now to the Make More with Matt Heslin podcast and join us every week for new expert insights and inspiration.
You are absolutely correct. This, by the way, goes back, stress testing, that is, goes back to capital adequacy. It's really to determine if a bank can withstand economic tremors and shocks, and it can be carried out in numerous ways. Early in my career, and by the way, everyone should serve on a nonprofit board and a credit union. And the reason I say credit union is good luck on getting on a bank board, because they are hard. You have to be invited. But I've been with a credit union for about 30 years, the same one for 30 some odd years. And I sat on their board for about 5 or 6 years. I enjoyed it. And Betty was our CFO at the time. This is the late 1990s, going into the early 2000s. She talked about stress testing, and Bruce, here I was, Mr. Analytical. I did not know anything she was talking about. It did not make sense, but she just had this glow in her eyes going through all the tests. And I just thought,
oh,
God bless her and God bless America. I mean, good for her.
There are so many people out there that revel in that type of stuff. And I think I'm with you there. It's, you know, the people that are like, the people that get excited when it's time for the annual audit, and the people that get excited because it's time to do taxes. And thank God there's Bettys in the world that get fired up for stress testing.
And by the way, Betty ended up becoming our CEO. It was very good in that role. So yeah, she was a numbers person, very gifted, but she also was great in leading and inspiring people. So I already had stress testing in my head.
Yeah.
I just never really, and yeah, doing a lot of financial modeling. Yeah. We do these what ifs, but I never really took stress testing to a whole new level until, I don't know why I picked it up and read it quickly, but right after Timothy Geithner wrote his book, Stress Test, when I saw that title, I thought, oh, I got to get that, because again, this mindset of stress testing. And by the way, it is a really good book. And so at the time when I read that, I happened to be a VAR for a driver-based financial modeling system. And of course, I'm thinking as I'm reading this book, and I gave it to one of the founders of the software I was peddling, I was thinking him and everybody on the planet who sell this modeling software would jump on this idea of stress testing. It never happened. It never transpired. So I really thought that just this whole idea of stress testing would take hold. But that is something we need to think about in light of SVB. But I want to do something with this word. One of my favorite people in the world, he's one of the most gifted talented IT people I've ever met. He is an expert at wine pairing.
Okay.
Well, I like pairing ideas, or anytime I recommend a book, I'll try to pair it with another. We just did that before we hit record on a couple of books.
Uh-huh.
Well, with stress testing, what is a good pairing? Resilience testing. And I think periodically, Bruce, maybe annually, maybe twice a year, we need to think about this business that we run is a rubber band. How far can we stretch it? How resilient until it breaks? And part of the stress testing, it may be with our supply chain. We learned a lot about supply chain. Supply chain is not just something to worry about in a war and those lines being broken. We learned a lot about supply chain during COVID, didn't we?
Yeah, yep, absolutely.
Vendor relationships. You know, when a vendor says, I can't meet this demand, it's going to be on buy, I can't make this. That can bring a company to its knees. Maybe someone on your leadership team diagnosed with a serious illness that you were not expecting. I think the concept of resilience testing, or if you want to say stress testing, I think that needs to be not necessarily front and center, but it needs to be in the back of our minds as we are building and growing our businesses.
I think it's an important topic. I'm trying to think through what might be the difference between a stress test and resilience testing. You know, part of what I'm thinking about is a stress testing. You've got set variables that you're going to ratchet up and down and see what happens. So that feels very controlled. Whereas resilience testing is, you know, almost like, let's see what I can mess with next. You know, what if I met with you? Let's mess with this. Let's mess with that. You know, what else do we want to mess with? And really just like, whereas stress testing is doing scenarios, it's like resilience testing is almost creating chaos and seeing what happens.
And even though I wasn't ready to talk about the differences between the two, since you're bringing it up, I kind of think of stress testing as big companies have financial modelers, period. Mm-hmm. The big companies, they have someone doing, and it may be a number of people doing financial modeling, and they're experts at it. So they're going to be naturally, what if margins go up, you know, 25 basis points, or, you know, what are we going to do? And so I think of stress testing more numerically, whereas resilience testing is really about stories. Again, what happens if that supply line gets broken or disrupted? What if you're a single product company and your manufacturer is in China, somewhere in a forest, and it burns down? What are you going to do? So to me, both are very helpful, but I'm just saying in the context of SBB, this is just something to be aware of, heightened sense of awareness.
And even in this situation, you know, would a stress test have laid out the end that this has come to? Because there have been some things that defy the numbers that affected this whole situation. It's, you know, there was the human element is what kicked this thing over the cliff. So
you are clairvoyant.
No.
Because that leads to my third idea. And again, I'm pulling out ideas that we can maybe either think about or apply in the midst of this crisis.
We've been hanging out too long.
And again, you're being clairvoyant because that leads to my third point. Again, this comes out of the banking Bible, if you will. So the OCC, was it Office of Comptroller
of the Currency.
Yep. Right. So the OCC has, I think, up to 9 categories of risk. Now, I'm old. It may be up to 32, but I'm aware of 9.
Okay.
And there's one that causes me to pause and think about it. And I thought, this is interesting. And it's applying to your point that you just brought up. Reputation risk.
Yeah.
How quickly can your business lose its reputation? Just
snap of fingers.
just like that. And why does a bank run start?
Because some people are afraid. There's an element of fear has been introduced into the process.
I was a little bit leery of bringing up this idea, but I thought, well, forget it. I'm going to bring it up anyway. But the reason I'm leery is because most of the CEOs I've ever worked with are very positive people. They're more likely to think positively than negatively. Now, I have worked with a few very negative-centric CEOs. Well, they don't stay. I don't remain on their payroll very long because they drag me down. So most of the people I work with, again, they are positive. So we probably don't think about this idea of reputation risk very much. I would just like to ask the question, who will you call if your reputation is at risk? Who will you call? Who will be the first person? I'm going to put you on the spot. If your business suffered some major hit to its reputation, do you know who you would call or email or reach out to? Oh, you had to think about it.
Yep. That's too long. And that's too long. That needs to be a reflexive action.
Agree. So my giveaway here, I'm not an expert at reputation risk. I'm not an expert. So my gift to you is start with that question and then figure out how are you going to answer that question. So that's really takeaway number one. I'll say this, Steve Jobs had Regis McKenna. Now, Regis McKenna has a PR background. Now, most of us cannot afford Regis McKenna. He's either semi-retired or he's in his highlight years. I know he does things that interest him, but he's at a season of life where he's not working full-time like he used to. We can't afford him, but I would start with find out a PR person. I think even a business under 50 million should have someone that it can go to that you are going to be my PR person. And usually it's crisis communicators. I'm not saying they all do, but many of them do come from a PR background. So that would be suggestion number one is answer that question and then start with the list of PR people and do it through your network. You know, if you're in Vistage or, you know, some other CEO group, start there and start asking, do you work with such a person? And you're going to start getting a very, very, well, when I say short list, it may be a short list of one. The other idea I have for you with respect to reputation risk is head over to E as in Edward 911. And those are the numbers. E as in Edward 911.com. It's founded by probably one of the most gifted crisis communication directors out there. He does a lot of public speaking. He's written a lot of books. So instead of just getting into the titles, just go to e911.com. Get very familiar with the content and start building your reputation risk acumen. Now, he's going to use the term crisis, but I still think reputation risk, they go hand in hand. So again, I think this is a relevant topic to address in light of what happened with SVB. Can I throw one more at you?
Sure. Ready.
Sorry if I'm talking too much.
No, this is interesting. You've already brought two angles to this and I've done a lot of reading on this and have been fascinated by this whole news stream, but you brought a couple of things that I hadn't even crossed my mind.
And by the way, you are an expert in an area where I'm not. I mean, you're more hands-on with this. Notice we're not talking about tactics. We're not talking about tactics from a CFO point of view. I'm looking at, again, you use the word holistic. I'm looking at this from a senior leadership team perspective. When I say tactics, you're the guy who's figuring out, well, do I need to be focusing on cash concentration and figuring out how to park cash and various. We're not getting into that topic. That's more tactical, and there are far better forums. CFO Bookshelf is about ideas, and it's about growing the human mind. And so that's why the focus on these four ideas, the last one, and it may be the last in terms of rank order, I'm going to suggest the Texas ratio. Did you read the book Friday Night Lights?
I did not.
It's a book that almost didn't get written. When it first did get written, the manuscript is almost 1,000 pages. I may be exaggerating by maybe 100 pages. It was terrible. Thankfully, Buzz, the author, had a really good editor, and she said, we need to rework this.
Tony La Russa.
Yeah.
Yes, I did read that.
There's a chapter, I don't know if it's dedicated, it's been a while since I read it. There's either a chapter or there are several chapters where he talks about the banking crisis, because there's a part of that book is dark, just because of the economic environment where he was writing at. And so that book was published in 1990, and the Texas oil crisis, or I should say maybe the boom that busted, I think was 86, 92. It was like this 6-7 year time period. And Texas ranked number one, not in football. Maybe they did, but they ranked number one in bank failures over that 6-7 year time failure.
Okay.
So there is this formula that came out called the Texas ratio. And I'm going to give you the incorrect formula for it. It's incorrect. You go look it up yourself. Go Google it. But because this is all about ideas, I took the formula and I'm tweaking it a little bit. So the formula is, again, my formula, non-performing assets divided by strong performing assets. Now, you can take assets and convert that to be customers. Your assets could be chinks in your delivery model. Well, let me rephrase that. It could be your delivery model, the way you get product to your customer base, client base. Mm-hmm. There could be chinks. Your asset could be obviously inventory. It could be people. So you can take that formula and apply it however you see fit. But I just think this ties a little bit to stress testing, but this is even getting a little bit more specific. Work with me here, Bruce. Okay. Can you see how this is maybe relevant or applicable?
Yeah. I definitely see it as applicable. I also see it as in a, you know, again, in the holistic state, of, you know, definitely subjective as far as determining what those items will be. But yeah, I mean, it's definitely it definitely shows like what percentage of your total of your total assets is troubled. Bigger is worse.
I've got Steve Jobs on my brain because as of this recording, it was just 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago that we did an interview and we focused on return to the Little Kingdom. It's a story about the early years of Apple, actually before and then during, going up to about, I want to say, the Apple II, and just getting up toward the introduction to the Macintosh. And this came after that book, but when Steve Jobs came back after he'd been fired, one of the first things he does is he starts cutting a lot of products, and the product base actually became more narrow, more focused, and profitability soared. Not right away, but it eventually did. That is one practical idea of this Texas ratio, non-performing assets divided by strong performing assets. I look at some consulting firms that I've been, can you be my sounding board? And one thing I do notice, Bruce, is sometimes it's like they're trying to sell seven different things. It's like, what's the main thing? Focus on it. So again, there are some unique ways that I think this formula can be applied, and especially in a qualitative way. I'm not putting the focus on the number. I'm taking it qualitatively. How can this be applied? It's a mental framework, if you will.
Yeah, because I mean, a lot of times, you know, the the supporting of those non-performing assets, I mean, there's costs associated with them, but some of those costs are also time and attention and focus.
Great point.
And those other, you know, really, really non-tangible costs of maintaining something that's not bringing any value.
Excellent. Excellent point. So I want to wrap this up. Those are the four big ideas that I've been thinking about related to what's going on with SVB and other banks that are crumbling. And all of these ideas, again, I pull them right out of the banking lexicon. There's one thing I don't want to be saying. I am not a person who believes we need to run our businesses or organizations in fear. That's the last thing I'm saying. But there is something to be said about Andy Grove and his title, Only the Paranoid Survive.
Yeah. You say that you say that often, and I think that's the nice, I think that's a good, you know, it's kind of a good reminder while you're also saying you got to stay positive.
I might even say, Bruce, a better way of thinking about Only the Paranoid Survive is something that Rita McGrath has said. Now, she didn't invent this term. She has a title called Sitting Around Corners. I know Jack Welch, the late Jack Welch, used to use that term, whether you like him or despise him. But sitting around corners is being able to see inflection points in business, or it can be outside of business, before they occur.
Yeah.
Can you imagine the leadership team, if they could see some of these inflection points, maybe 1.5 years before they happen at Silicon Valley Bank? Would the results have changed?
You know, it's
an unfair question.
Yeah. I mean, it's looking in the rearview mirror at this point. You know, it's you know, they, and I don't remember exactly the classification, but there's, you know, it's smart people learn from their mistakes. Geniuses learn from the mistakes of others. And so I think it's, you know, and you were talking about why CFO Bookshelf is so important and all these other things, and having these conversations is if we can learn from others' mistakes, either through books or deep diving into the news and current events, maybe that provides a little bit of that view around the corner.
Bruce Reed, you're the Chief Financial Officer for PracticeLink. You're my favorite CFO. Quick question. We've been talking for 34 minutes. Hope I did not bore you.
Absolutely. This is a good topic.
What,
I enjoyed this.
What was one of your favorite takeaways in this conversation?
You know, part of it is, I think looking at the banking ratios, you know, when we first talked about we were going to have this conversation, thinking, oh my gosh, you know, you look through banking compliance and banking due diligence is really a thick topic. And it's not accessible to necessarily, like I say, the small to mid-sized business person.
Right.
Because to really jump into financial statements and things like that and get anything out of them, you need a robust analytical team to really go through and dig through, you know, dig through the messaging and get to the real numbers. And so what the big takeaway here is just because you don't have the resources to do a full due diligence on a 10K, you do have, everybody has the resources to apply in a holistic manner these different frameworks. So I think that's the big thing is I came into this feeling like this was unattainable, and I come out of it feeling like there is an attainable level of insight and knowledge that can be taken from these processes.
Bruce, we could spend another hour on this, but I think we get the ideas, the frameworks, I think hopefully can be helpful. Thank you again, Bruce. Appreciate it.
You're welcome. Always a pleasure. Thank you.
You are listening to CFO Bookshelf, lifelong learning for financial leaders. And now back to our host, Mark Gandy.
Before we wrap up, about every week to 2 weeks, I get an email on LinkedIn, which goes something like this. Mark, I want to take that next step. I want to get to the CFO level or that VP of finance role. And while I enjoy those back and forth emails, I'd be remiss if I didn't mention the CFO Leadership Council, which I personally call the Vistage or the YPO for financial leaders. If you want the collaboration of some 2,000 CFO peers, check out CFOLeadershipCouncil.com. Back to stress testing for a minute. The Prussian military was the first to implement war games. This is dating back to, I believe, the early 1800s. Officers divided into two groups. One was red, the other was blue. So you remember high school debate where we had red team, blue team? That's where that comes from. Essentially, this is one of the early examples of an organization stress testing its own strategies to see if they would hold up or fail. So stress testing is more than just changing a few numbers in a spreadsheet to see outcomes. Finally, I want to follow up on my last comment about being too negative and living in constant fear. Perhaps a healthy dose of paranoia is needed, which we brought up near the end. Now, you have probably read these words before. Here they are, quote, "Day two is stasis, followed by irrelevance, followed by excruciating, painful decline, followed by death." And that's why it's always day one. I'm interested in the question, how do you fend off day two? What are the techniques and tactics? How do you keep the vitality of day one? Those are the words of Jeff Bezos, dated April 12th, 2017, in the 2016 letter to shareholders. So day one is about maintaining a customer-centric, long-term focus. Always. That's why it's always day one at Amazon. So Jeff, he's asking the same questions Bruce and I asked about how we are assessing the current banking crisis. And we answered it with four simple mental models or frameworks that I hope you found useful that you can start applying today in your company. We need to call this a wrap. I want to thank my friend Bruce Reed, the CFO at PracticeLink, for joining me. I'm Mark Gandy for CFO Bookshelf.